All right, thank you. Yeah, well, it's great to be back at KITP again to reconnect with old friends and meet new ones. So as organizer of the program here, I've actually had the pleasure of putting many people on the spot. But I've actually never given one of these myself, and so this is payback time. Michael, thank you. but I'm very happy to share with you my journey in biology, which started really, I think, 16, 17 years ago in 2001 program that started. So what I would like to tell you about is some of the challenges we encounter in biology, and why I'm excited to be working on this. Okay, of course, I will tell you through some concrete program, some concrete problem working on, so you have some meat. But then, before we start, let me just give you some general remarks to set the stage. So one of the themes that keep on emerging, no matter what area of biology one looks into, is the connection from some micro scale to macro scale. Right? So for molecular cellular biologists, the micro scale would be the molecular interaction, and the macro will be the property of a cell. If you're interested in development, if you look at the organism, so your micro scale will be cellular interaction, right? And you look at the emergence of a tissue, body, these properties, right? So, say tissue, organism, right? And if you're an ecologist, this program is ongoing, then your micro scale will be really organism. Right. And then you're talking about communities and such. Now, the thing about this list is that as for each of these problems, okay, if you look at this scale, it's a big mess, extremely complicated, lots of things interacting with each other. And if you look at this scale, if you look at it long enough, right, and then it becomes simple. Right? Individuals may look at your hands and put it simple, right? The two hands match each other. Right? okay. Right, in the context of a developing embryo, one thinks of a cell as just something, okay, and then you look at how they organize together. But of course, ultimately, evolution happens at a molecular scale, and then so there's really a link tracing all the way from here to here. Right. Okay, so now, what biologists would like us to do, right, is to go from here to here. And there's a from the molecular scale all the way to complicated things. Now, there's a good reason to ask for that, right? So a lot of the experiments they do, what they can detect, they can see, is at a small scale, right? That's what you can manipulate. And if you're talking about something practical, you want to treat cancer, then you want to figure out, what pathway to block to stop the growth of cancer. At least that's the current way of thinking about it. Right? And again, you ultimately want to know something about how the micro scale affects properties at the large scale. Okay, but if you look at this problem front on, it's extremely complicated. Right? And complicated, you can use different measures, but one example would just be just really a macroscopic number of parameters. Right? We all believe that at the end, everything, there's no more than chemistry going on, maybe at the smallest scale, right? But then every chemical reaction describes some parameters, and even going from here to here for simple bacterial cells, you're talking about maybe millions of parameters, right? Because all of these players are different. Okay? And this also presents a practical challenge for us physicists. At least I never, during my school, I never learned about any tools that allow me to look at the, even hundreds of parameters, not to say millions of parameters, right? I mean, I can approximate them by random parameters, but probably there's more to it than that, okay? And it's not like these parameters are all not important, because eventually evolution does happen by changing a few parameters to see that new innovations are developed and so forth. Okay. So that's the challenge. So it's almost like you're in the world. Let's say you're looking at you're sitting gas in this room, and you're in a world where you can see like every particle. You have ways to measure every particle that's bombarding with each other, colliding, and so forth. Okay, but then you are in that world, right? And you don't really at the highest scale. I mean, okay, for the gas, we know there are things like pressure and temperature and so forth, okay? But then when you're in this world, all you see are the particles bombarding, okay? So there's some other difficulty. Why I like about this, this type of problems? Well, it's about from complexity to simplicity, right? I mean, that's the job descriptor of physicists. And everything we don't understand is called complex, right? And our physicists are supposed to go into a subject where nothing is understood, and think about it, and eventually organize into something that's clean, and we'll have a way to think about it. And if you need to do calculation, there's a way to do calculation, right? So that's like a great pushing problem. And in fact, I went to graduate school, studied statistical mechanics, exactly trying to go. I thought this is the subject that deals with this connection. However, statistical mechanics has gotten so good, it's what the type of problems that it addresses, right? These days, more times, even already in my graduate school times, in statistical mechanics, we're more thinking about how to get complex property, non-trivial properties of simple interactions, right? And the non-trivial phases, phase transitions, and such, okay? But so this is one of the few problems really getting looking a really a big mess, right? And how to deal with it. I mean, that's a challenge built for physicists. Then another thing I like about this type of problem, right, is it's really open, right? So there's no Hamiltonian. Nobody's telling you about Feynman diagrams, anything, right? And anything goes. Okay. At the end of the day, if you do something, it's very clear. I mean, why is my left hand the same as right hand, even though they're so far apart from each other during development and everything, right? So there are these very concrete, simple problems, right? It somehow is coming through these interactions. But then there's so much is not understood in terms of lack of a framework of an organization or anything. I think in physics, we'll have to really go back a long time to get to this type of problem, right? So the first case I think of is maybe over 100 years ago, in the late 1800s, people are compiling line spectrums of different transitions, right? You have a telephone book worth of a line spectrum, right? And ultimately, of course, we know it can all be boiled down to one little formula, right? So it's about energy difference. And maybe even way before that, maybe 200 years ago, beginning of when people start to look at steam engines, the heat engine, things like that. Okay, it's really, one doesn't know what's heat, right? It took a long time to figure out what heat was. So it's really biology in this area, basically, Wild West. Like anything goes, no rule, no nothing. And one encounters this type of problem probably once every 100 years. And since I'm living this age, why not get diving into this problem? Okay. Okay.
Could it not be that biology, God is in the details?
That's right. That could always.
Things are not useful.
Absolutely. So that's the risk one takes, right, when diving into that. So in the 90s, when I said still at Harvard, was saying I was going to biology. Let's see. I'm looking for one person, Daniel Fisher here, right? Daniel said, biology is the economy of Brazil. Okay. ask him what he's doing now. Okay, so yeah, there's always that risk. But you know, you live only once, right? And so the way I recruit graduate students to our program is that if you're, this is 2017, right? So if you're in 1917, right? Would you want to go, to, what would you work on? Would you go on to work on the Maxwell's theory of everything, right? Or do you want to work on this little thing called quantum mechanics? Well, before there was quantum mechanics, right? Okay, so you take a chance. Maybe it's all in the details. So, but then on the other hand, this, even the details are rather amazing, right? I mean, details that give you this kind of precision. But very few people, or in terms of percentage, have more than five fingers or less than fewer than five fingers. Okay. So that's a special opportunity. And then the thirdly is I really like the style of doing this kind of a science, sort of a day-to-day routine. Okay. So. Maybe many of you know that at some point during a journey in biology, we started a lab. It's really a way to cheat, right? It's just by thinking is that universal way to cheat, right? By collecting some data. And so there's it's a very nice routine of, you can think about something that, you're not sure which path to take, and you do experiment, right? And then in a day or two, you get a result, and you think some more, and you do another experiment. So there's a natural sort of a pace in doing the science. Okay, it's a dialogue. Okay, you're thinking and you're doing something, right? And it's a kind of a thing sort of maybe in my romantic view that's what science sort of ought to be. But then 21st century, 20th century physics has advanced to such a level that really you cannot do that. You have to specialize, right? But this allows us to do some of that, right? So all these reasons. To get into biology.
So do you think biology has evolved to the point where we'll have a lot of standalone theorists, or just a few?
I think it's at the stage where it does not warrant the division between theory and experiment. Right. You can contribute in whatever way. Well, all right. Okay, so much for my sort of overview, my personal perspective. And let me talk to you about one particular problem that we've been working for almost 10 years at this point. Okay, so it's about bacterial growth. Okay, so biology is about growth and survival. Okay, and I'm going to tell you about growth, much easier to study than survival, I think. And so I'm going to tell you about cell growth. And for me, a cell is a bacterium cell. Or more specifically, E. coli, because that's what we study. Okay. okay, so you have a cell, it's an elongated rod-like cell, and you put it into a growth medium. That is, you provide some external nutrient, glucose and ammonia. So glucose provides carbon source. Ammonia provides nitrogen, so basically life is a carbon-nitrogen complex. Okay, and plus some other essential small amount of metals, it will grow, and in some time t, doubling time, this cell has grown to twice its size. Right, and okay, so then the cell division and so forth. I'm not even going to bother with cell division, so I'm just interested in this. Aspect of how sort of a cell kind of grows while everything is happening, okay? And I'm going to, instead of a doubling time, it's convenient to introduce growth rate called lambda, which is just log 2 over the doubling time, okay? Now, this whole process is exponential. So if you look at the lens expands exponentially. If you measure particular proteins inside a cell, its abundance also increases exponentially, okay? So exponential growth. So, question is, what does this basic process of growth depend on? So it depends on many things. It, for example, depends on the properties of the enzymes. The faster the enzymes, maybe the faster it can grow. It depends on regulation. That's a word before into physics, but then it's a pretty important role. I'll talk about it later. It depends on what nutrients are fed, maybe the amount, and also the type. Right? It depends on temperature, or maybe it depends on pH, osmolarity, all of that. Yeah?
Does it grow enough before it divides?
It would grow to twice the size and divide, and each cell would then repeat over again. Okay, but then for what I will talk about, the division is not even important. You can also have a mutant that do not divide; they just keep on going like a long sausages. Okay, so the properties I'm talking about, the basic growth does not. So the division is just cutting the sausage. Right, we first have to have the sausage. All right, okay, so these are specified the genomes, so we call the genetic parameters, right? And these are the environmental parameters. And in addition, you may have in the environment there may be other cells, right? So they would maybe compete with the nutrient. They would secrete other stuff to help or hurt the growth of these cells, and ultimately they affect through these changing these environmental parameters, but then because they're alive, they can also play games and so forth. So that's yet another game. So that's a sort of ecological. Okay, and the question here is really, right? The question here is really, how does growth depends on all of this internal and external environment? Okay. And you might want to know them, because for bacteria, if it's infecting your body, you'll find a way to interfere with this growth. And if this instead of a bacteria, it's a cancer, then you want to find a way to stop those, right? So always this understanding how the cell organizes its growth program is important central questions. Okay, to answer this question, I'm going to start from telling you what the cell has to do to double, okay, just from the output end. Okay, so cell composition. Okay, so in this hour, I'm going to build a cell for you, right? And give you a way to think about it. So the cell is made of water, mostly. That's about 70%. And the rest called the dry mass, so that's now water. So you just bake it, and eventually water disappears. Whatever you end up with is the other 30%. Okay, out of the biomass, out of this biomass, about I would say 60 to 80% the proteins. Okay, maybe 10 to 30% are molecules called RNA. Okay, they add up to about 90%. The rest 10% the cell wall and stuff. Okay, so it's a reminder.
DNA itself is
negligible. Yeah, a few percent, providing a template. All right, so for the purpose of looking at how cell grows, I'm going to focus on the proteins, the major. Yes, please. They maintain constant. Okay, how do they do that is a great question. So water in pretty much all living system, water is about 70%. But of course you can change that by changing external osmolarity, right? You can suck water out, that would change. But normally they like to keep this. Cell wall will continue. Cell wall gets inserted to expand this whole thing in an exponential way. Okay. All right. So let's focus on the proteins. So proteins are polymers of a 20 amino acids. Okay? And these amino acids are basically carbon and nitrogen. So they're from glucose and ammonia. Okay? So roughly speaking, so if this is a boundary of the cell, we have a external carbon coming in, right? And this carbon then is used for two purposes. You use it to build stuff, so that's basis of a biomass. So the carbons are broken down into a set of universal precursors. So across all organisms, there are about a dozen of such molecules that biology used to build everything. Okay, so whatever you eat, it's got broken down into these 12 things. Okay? And in addition, you extract from carbon. Carbon for many organisms is also is a source of energy, right? So you extract from it, basically it's an electron in carbon that's important. The carbon-carbon bond, the electron. So when you burn, a carbon, I mean, you're basically liberating the electron, you're putting in oxygen to get that energy, okay? So you extract the electron, then bring it to some electron carrier, whose whole purpose is basically a collaborative structure to delocalize electrons so you have less energy. Electron and ATP, okay? Now, then these guys, then I put together the 12 of them, and together with the electrons, and together with the nitrogen, to make amino acids.
So the oxygen and the hydrogen you get for free from the water.
The oxygen it's an important external agent because it's only with oxygen that you get the most out of energy out of a carbon. Without oxygen, then you do not extract as much energy out. All right, you make your
sulfur.
I'm not talking about, of course, the amino acids that need sulfur. The other small parts that need sulfur. I'm just talking kind of big budget item, okay. Right? Just to see what it takes to make two cells. Okay, and amino acid, then they're eaten. They're put together by a machine called ribosome to make proteins. I'm running out of space here to make proteins. Okay, and then what do these proteins do? Well, every one of these steps requires proteins. So these are called the biosynthetic protein. These are called the catabolic proteins for the breakdown. And so these proteins supply what you make is exactly to carry out that program. Okay, and also you need protein. Ribosomes are also proteins themselves. Okay, so that's a program. all right. Bear with me a bit about the details. I want to give you some detail because by the end of the day, we're going to collapse these details. Okay. So, a lot of proteins are enzymes. So what do enzymes do? So they take, so you may have two molecules, small molecules, X and Y. And if they're sitting there by themselves in a test tube, it may take 1,000 years for them to produce a product. Okay, but with enzymes, you increase the rate. Okay, so this is done by these enzymes. And so enzymatic reactions typically can be written down by these Michaelis-Menten equations, so concentration of the changes of various things. Just write it down. So there's some rate. It's proportional to the enzyme concentrations. And then you have some dependence on the substrate. Okay, just as an example. Okay, so a lot of enzymes basically describe, but they do things, they make reactions possible in biological timescales. Okay, so apply this to a problem of protein synthesis. So these are genetically determined, so properties of enzymes. Okay, so what they say is that if you have lots of substrate, then you can forget about this factor, then how fast you go is determined by enzyme concentration.
But, is it K multiplied by the concentration of E or K as a function?
Oh, this little K is multiplied by, yeah. So this it's a rate. So per enzyme, how fast the reaction goes. Okay, so you see one enzyme in this case has three parameters already, but you can, if there are more reactants, have more parameters. Okay. So how does the protein synthesis go? Okay, just hang on a little bit. It's going to get pretty complicated, right? But I don't expect you to remember everything, but just just give you a taste, okay? So you have a amino acid, the 20 of these, okay? It's put together, so it comes together with a one particular RNA molecule. There are at least 20 of these, okay? And they got put together by enzyme, so they grind together, form what's called a charged tRNA species, and this requires enzyme, one for each of these process, and it requires ATP, okay? Now, this thing, so you have amino acid together with a tRNA. It's sitting by itself, it just falls apart. It's bond, it takes energy to make, and it's very easily torn apart. So in a cell, the cell puts an enzyme called an EFTU to escort every one of these that's needed to make amino acid. Okay, you have a protein escorting it to form what's called a ternary complex. And there's one for each of these amino acid species, at least. Then these guys are what feeds into the ribosome.
Okay, same enzyme for same TU.
It's the same TU. This is the most abundant protein in fast-growing cells. Because every little amino acid, basically, useful ones, is escorted by a protein.
They
bind to everyone. Right. These guys are special. Okay. And so this ternary complex is what's getting fed into the ribosome. Okay. So all of this, I'm just expanding this one step. Okay. And so ribosome, so here's a messenger RNA, that's the instruction for making a certain protein. A ribosome is a big protein complex, sit on this, and it reads what sort of the next, so it makes a protein, it translates from mRNA, it makes protein, and it reads the next instruction code on the mRNA, okay? And if it's the right variety matching this code, then this is fed into the ribosome, so ribosome go from an open accepting situation to a closed situation. And then along the way, so the amino acid in there is delivered to the ribosome, and these TU and the tRNA gets returned so that they can go on again. Okay? And then the ribosome then does its job by putting the next amino acid onto the growing peptide chain. It goes back with the help of another protein. Okay, so this whole process at the end is you're adding an amino acid to an extending polypeptide chain. Okay, and so the eventual sort of output is a ribosome moving along. Why am I telling you all of this? Okay, so just give you an idea. Ultimately, if you say the total synthesis rate, right, so protein synthesis J, that's the flux, it's proportional to the number of ribosomes you have, and it's proportionally constant, just how fast each ribosome works. Okay, the reason I want to tell you about all of this is that this proportionality constant, we call the elongation rate of ribosome, it depends on the count parameters, right? So each of this reaction has three of these, multiplied by 20 is 60, and so on and so forth, okay? You have several hundred parameters going into this translation rate, okay?
Could not the
rate limiting? Right. I mean, in principle, anything can be rate limiting. And if you're just looking at it, you have no idea what it's. You can force something to be limiting by depriving yourself of certain things. Okay? And then that one branch will be important. But in general, if you just want to describe a cell growing in a rich medium, which step are you supposed to focus on? Right? It could be anything. Okay. But if that's all there is, life is simple. Okay, and would not work very well. The key to this is regulation, which I haven't talked about. So here's regulation. So as external nutrient level change, the amino acid supply is going to change. Okay, the cell needs, the rate of making these things are different. So cell compensates the making of this machinery. Right. So if we go back to this thing here, we know that ribosome itself, so something in here, in this Coarser diagram is just some abundance of amino acid. There's a positive arrow. Okay, more of a amino acid substrate for ribosome, more substrate, more ribosome cell mix. Okay, it makes sense, right? Ribosome is serving, making the amino acid. If you have lots of customers, okay, there's some signal that tells it to make more of it, okay, to consume. And these precursors, they throw a block here. If I have lots of precursors, stop having more things coming in. Okay? And then, again, some combination like here and here throws a switch on biosynthesis. I represented this in a simpler way than it is. What actually is known as a molecular excavation, there's some molecule that's involved in doing this. Exactly where it comes from, where the signal comes from, is not known. Okay? Okay, so that these are some suggestive informations at the qualitative level. Okay, now you're supposed to make some sense of that. Okay, so now you can ask, okay, so this is the rate of making the output. Where do they come from? It's just right here. So the raw material provided, of course, by the influx, by carbon influx. Okay, and if everything's working out well, we should have this. So you eat glucose, that converts to some unit of amino acid. If you eat glycerol, it's some other unit. This is just a material specific constant of conversion of the masses. And so this is the stuff coming in, flux coming in. And this is a simpler. I'm going to write this as some catalytic constant multiplied by the concentration of this influx protein to force approximation. Okay, so now let me tell you about.
And why are we going into linear response regime? Why would life do that?
The what?
Linear response. So everything is simply proportional.
So this is so if you look at Michaelis equation. Right, so for the influx, this is simple because you usually provide a lot of a nutrient, so you can forget about the substrate, and then the influx, the protein just work in maximum capacity. But it turns out this seems to be a more general the case, and we'll talk about that maybe at the end. Okay, so the next question is how much of a what protein? Clearly, I already told you. In this diagram, several different varieties. These enzymes that put tRNA together with amino acid, ribosome, importers, right? So so we have in the cell 4,000 plus types of proteins encoded in the genome of a Pol E. coli. And the abundance of each could be from a few per cell, right, to 10 to the fourth per cell. And so this is done. So there are 4,000 genes, and each of these genes is spitting out mRNAs. It's called message RNA with some rate, say alpha I. This is gene I, right? And then each mRNA, you have a ribosome, maybe several ribosome hopping onto it, and they're making proteins. Okay, these proteins at the cellular rate beta. And these mRNAs also getting degraded with some other rate and so forth. Okay, so there you have all of these processes going on. But what we're going to write for this process is that ultimately the change in the concentration of any particular protein is, okay, so the total production is a Jp. That's the rate ribosome output. They're making all of the proteins. A fraction chi I of them goes to each individual protein, all right? And then there's also a dilution factor because the cell, the volume, everything is expanding. Okay, so you have this one equation about protein synthesis. Now the key is,
yeah. Degradation of proteins?
Protein degradation, there's some proteins that are specifically degraded, but for a growing E. coli, in exponential growth phase, 95% of them are very stable, so don't forget about them, okay? Now, the key is this. This is unknown, because this is these regulatory processes. It's not even clear what really goes into them, and not to say what, how they do their job. Okay, so this depends on all of the possibly amino acid, ATP, anything you can think of, right? And you do not even know what goes in rather than something. Another thing is this regulatory function, they add up to one. Because that is, if all of the ribosomes are working, then, you know, this is just allocation of the product to different proteins. All right, so now I've expanded kind of to a big scale, okay? And now it's time to close the ring. Yeah, these things are all time dependent. Because especially, let's say, if you're changing environment, even in the laboratory, when I say increase or decrease the concentration of the substrate, right? Everything is changing. These guys are function of time. Everything's function of time.
Okay. Yeah. But when the cell is working properly,
when it's working exponentially, then can forget about time, and that's exactly what I'll talk about next. Okay, this will be useful to help us to understand what's happening. There'll be
small fluctuation.
You know. And this thing is so complicated, just try to find some daylight, okay? All right. So let's talk about steady state. And by steady state, I mean the exponentially growing steady state, right? Okay. So set DDT to zero. Then what we have is, so steady state, I just mark by an asterisk. Okay, so chi and Jp. Jp is the elongation rate times ribosome concentration. Okay, sometimes I get tired of putting asterisks, I forget, but these are steady state stuff, okay? Growth rate times protein. I can sum them up. Okay, sum of this is one. So then the total output of a ribosome multiplied by the elongation rate, that is its growth rate times the total protein content. Okay, total protein content is basically a number. I told you, you know, these things are all fixed, about 80% protein. So this is just a total protein is just a number. Okay. So then,
so that's the concentration, so it's not increasing.
Per water. Right, that's an intensive quantity. All right, so you put these two together, then we see that the fraction, in steady state, the fraction is just, it gives the amount of a protein, so that's a kind of a trivial thing. If nothing else is going on, how much I direct my resource to is what fraction of stuff I make. Okay, all right. Now, it turns out, these things are rather easy to measure. Okay, so now I come to, for the first time, I come to measurement. You have to have measurement, right? So let me just give you a plot. So if you measure, in particular, we can say this chi ribosome, fraction dedicated to ribosome, is just ribosome concentration. over the total protein concentration. So this is particularly easy to measure. So easy that even 50, 60 years ago, when molecular biology was not developed, they already could measure this. To measure this, for you give cells with different growth medium, so you have a way to change the growth rate. Okay, what you get is data like this, described by a very good straight line.
With a
non-zero intercept. Okay. All right, so we say, fine. So this is a particular notation plus some constant, some slope and a constant, right? I'll interpret this for you later. And then if you plug into this, the elongation rate is just by the formula growth rate divided by the ribosome content. And that comes out to be a Michaelis function of a growth rate. So the elongation rate, faster you grow, the bit faster you elongate. Okay? So you get something like that. So then this parameter gamma is maximum elongation, how fast ribosome can go. All right, so there's more interpretation to this, but I want to stay just at this phenomenological level. It's fine. Okay, so we have this. Now, I'll go back here. So that's about the ribosome output. Then you can also talk about the influx. So this influx is just the carbon input of protein over total protein. That's also easily measured. Again, you can do this 50 years ago. And what you get, you feed it with different medium, you get this kind of data, another straight line. Okay, so we'll write this. Okay, so there's some characteristic growth rate let me see. Okay, now what I came here is that with these two lines, we can solve the problem back up there.
What does solving the problem mean?
So this one, right? So we want to know, in principle, as nutrients fluctuating, everything's changing, how do we describe what the cell is doing? How fast it grows, protein concentration, and everything. Okay? So
you'll predict the maximum growth rate?
Not maximum, so we can predict things like if you switch from one medium to another medium, how long it takes to go from one to the other, what's the order of how ribosome change, how catabolic protein change, and that sort of things.
Okay. Very naive question.
Yeah.
Why is it possible that the steady state carbon, the C star is the steady state carbon input flux?
Yeah, sorry. So this is, so we have an in steady state, right? We can, by measuring the actual protein amount, we can deduce the fraction of a flux going into this directed to each protein.
Right.
Okay. Now I'm going to use this to get to the dynamics.
But that carbon flux goes to zero if it goes to
zero? No, this is a fraction, right? So what this means is that the fraction, but this is basically the concentration. This is a constant. Okay. So what I'm plotting is a carbon importer concentration. What the cell is doing, okay, is if growth medium is good, its growth rate is good, then it dials down on the amount to take up stuff. And it increases, where's the other plot? Here, right? It increases, it's balancing between upstream and the downstream. Okay? So it's making these adjustments. All right, so I trapped myself. All right, so I'm going to make an onset. Okay, so the key problem is we do not know what this depends on. Okay, but generally, there's a feeling that as the substrate level increases, right, then this increases. It dials up ribosome concentration. And also, I showed you that for this elongation rate, as growth condition becomes good, it grows better. Both this, okay, so let me first write down. I'm going to follow an onset. So this regulation function, which in principle depends on everything in the world, okay? So I'm going to say it depends on everything in the world through a particular way, through how the elongation rate depends on everything in the world. Okay? And this is a function. I know this function because I already know in steady state how these things depend on each other. So I told you how this depends on growth rate, and I plotted for you how these functions depend on growth rate, so I can just substitute.
Could there be a different sigma?
No, sigma is just elongation rate. That's just one thing.
And that's known to be independent of particular amino acids.
It's actually the elongation, so this is the average, okay, the average elongation rate. Okay? And this comes never mind. But this is the simplest sort of thing we're going to do. Okay? So when you do that, of course, things simplify. So we're going to write down an equation of motion for sigma, the elongation rate, which is this total protein flux over ribosome concentration. That's its definition over here. Right? And this protein synthesis rate depends on the input. So I can write this as alpha kc. So it's a ratio of the input protein versus the output workhorse. Okay? So now I have a closed system. In particular, if I write down equation motion for this, just applying chain rules and using these equations, right, then end up with this very simple equation. Okay, and now both of these guys are just functions. Now I have a single ODE, okay, the form of which I learned from a steady state system. It's a closed system. These are pretty simple ODEs to solve. You can solve it exactly, and then you can compare to the world. Okay? And the solution of this equation, it matches to us. Well, we measured, so what do you get? Okay, so what you study. So chi's are these, so the steady state ones that we determine. Okay, so it depends on the same way. Form is the same, right? But these guys are changing, so that it generates the time. Okay, so what kind of things we do? We can. So for example, we can change median. You initially in a kind of a slow median with initial growth rate, you switch to a fast median with some high growth rate, you can look at how different ways this can be approached. You can switch in the same equation. These are the boundary conditions. You have to tell from where to where, right? And then if this is the asymptotic, then what you get is some kind of thing like that. go forward. So, and not only that, then this also provides predictions for what the ribosome concentration, kind of body concentration, and all that. Right? Now, if I have a slide, that will show you how well they match. I mean, for something simple like that, it's matching very well. Right? No parameters. Okay, so what this equation has is four constants from this basically slope and intercept of the steady state law, right? And initial boundary conditions. That's what you do. Okay? And the company specifies it.
So there's some implicit assumption about slow and fast time scales, so that if you make a change,
right,
you go off these curves,
right,
and you go back to the curve,
right,
very fast.
So yeah, so obviously with this core screening, I'm not keeping track of at the minute scale how the metabolites are changing. There's no metabolites here. Okay? But basically from 15 minutes sort of on, we're capturing the protein changes. Okay, so then you use a method to actually measure the individual proteins and see how they change. Right? So if you zoom in the different time scales, protein level change like this, and this is the details that this equation is able to capture. Okay, so what it reveals at the end is that a regulation strategy that's really very simple, it is a one dial control. If you go fast, if you're in good median, you go to make ribosome, and you put your resource to ribosome rather than input flux. If you're a poor medium, then you're not going to go very fast anyway. You dial back. Okay, with all of that stuff, right? It's very simple control. And we also have a guess of exactly where in this thing that this regulation is coming from. We're testing that. Okay. Okay. So that's one part on the kinetics. But then really from this work, the sort of interesting part to us is where did these lines come from? Okay, because that's really at the bottom of everything, right? And four constants is too many for us, right? So I'm going to now, the remaining 10 minutes, I'm going to dive into that a bit, okay? See where these lines come from. All right. Oh, there's a chi for everything, right? For every protein there is one, okay? But if you look.
The final equation, I thought.
Right. So this equation, because I'm dealing with the input and output, all it depends on these two. Yeah.
for some intermediate state, but these are constraining.
The what?
The other chi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'll
answer these. So we'll just need to look at the steady state. Never mind about the dynamics. Okay. So I told you, right? So this chi of R. So when we change nutrients to provide poor carbon, so this is the growth rate. Then there's a linear relation. I told you. There's that. This is chi C. There's that relation. Okay? So this result was actually known since the 60s. Okay? At that time, when it first came out, it was sort of it's like competing with the Watson and Crick. It's almost as interesting. So this is kind of obvious, the quantitative people are attracted to that, right? But then, obviously, with DNA and molecular biology, that really took off, right? And nothing much happened to this. Okay,
there was a theoretical explanation that was forgotten?
Well, the explanation was basically, if you forget about the offset, okay, then it's just that you need more ribosome. This is basically measuring ribosome, right? So it's just if you have more, I mean, you need to produce more, then you need to have more ribosome.
Right.
Okay? But then the offset was sort of the big problem that just threw it off the wall. Because, well, anyway. But the fact is nothing much happened to it, okay? So when we looked at this, and I find out about this, the first author of that work was retired in San Diego and just happened. No, very few people remember this work back in the 50s, right? And we got so intrigued and looked into it, and so we were asking ourselves why nothing more happened to it, okay? So then we realized that this is one piece of something There should be something else to go along with it. Right? So there are at least two variables here. One is the change of the neutron. Another is the elongation rate. Okay, because this gamma, the slope of this, tells you about how fast ribosomes work. So we then, in the spirit of thermodynamics, then we ask, well, here you're fixing the elongation rate and you're changing the nutrient. Okay? So then we ask, well, what would happen if we do the orthogonal change? Right? We fix the nutrient but change the elongation. So that you can do by, say, applying an antibiotic, which a lot of antibiotics block translation. So to our surprise, we get, so let's say here's a nutrient. Right? Then when we fix the nutrient, change the elongation, we get another straight line. Right? We fix a nutrient somewhere else, a polar nutrient, change, apply drug, change elongation, we get another straight line. Okay, they seem to merge towards some similar point. Similarly, over here, if you look at the input reporting, you fix this nutrient, you apply antibiotics, it goes down towards the origin. Right? Goes down towards the origin. Okay, then. Now, then, by this point, that we're really shocked, right? With all this complicated stuff in the background, it's drawing straight lines for us. Right? So for, you know, for someone just struggling with all these parameters, this just cannot be better news. Right? The straight lines we can handle. And moreover, when you look at detail, these straight lines sort of match with those straight lines. There's some symmetry to it. Okay. so if we want to write down, then so this set already. Say this is, say, some constant plus this. And then these guys you can write as some maximum chi max minus, it's a negative slope. Now, here we put a slope that has, we know has the slope has something to do with nutrient, because better nutrient have a poorer slope. Okay, so this is something, related neutron. And similarly, then you get also the complementarity here. So this is basically a lambda neutron. And this is, okay, so this is still where we wrote it. Okay, so now it's ready to be put together, right? And so we introduced a very simple theory. So the theory says if you look at a proteome as a pie, then you have a portion that's for ribosome, a portion for catalytic pudding, a protein maybe for biosynthesis or something. Okay. And to grow, you need to have ribosomes. Okay, that's just writing down this line. To grow, you need to have a catabolic protein. To grow, you need to have anabolic protein. And they add up to five and chi, the same thing. Sorry. Okay. So this theory has one. You have to simultaneously meet these conditions. To grow, the more ribosome you have, the faster you can grow. Okay? The more catabolic protein you have, you can grow, and so forth. And that is constrained. The total resource is fixed.
So all the same lambda is
just has to be the same, right? So basically, you know, you have four variables, the three phis and the lambda. Okay? And you solve these four equations simultaneously, you get your result. All right? Okay, so phi q is a one fudge parameter in this theory. Okay, that is, there is a other portion of the protein, all the proteins, this is experimentally determined. Okay, that about 50% of them are off limit to these growth. These are growth proteins. Then there's something that's set aside. Something. Okay, so the theory has one parameter, which is a genetically encoded, and then these three. You can call them parameters, or you can call them variables, because they're the ones that couple to external world. If I change carbon, I'm changing this. right? If I change with a drug, I'm changing this. Okay? So theory has one parameter. You can make all kinds of predictions about under different conditions what happens to the cell. And we have made lots of tests, and they work very well in different situations.
What's A?
A is basically this part. I just, for simplicity, I didn't include the same thing. Here. So you can change that by limiting nitrogen, for example.
Sorry?
Yeah. Sorry? Bacteria don't have mitochondria.
Pardon?
Bacteria don't have mitochondria, but they have energy, right? So,
okay.
Yeah. So it turns out, at least in the aerobic condition we studied, energy is really a very small part. Okay, but we can't, so in the various way we test this this theory. Let me just go very quickly. Okay, so the first way we test this was if we force the cell to express useless protein, okay, then it's like increasing this Q as far as growth is concerned. Okay, then you're just squeezing down on these growth proteins, right? And immediately have a prediction. As I increase this Q by forcing the cell to express useless protein, then the growth rate will just drop linearly, right? And we can tell you, if you express that much protein, the people use E. coli to make insulin or whatever now, right? We can tell them exactly how much growth is slowed down, right? No fitting parameters, right? And they work very well. Then we can look at, say, in this carbon input, we have this line, right? And we're going to say, well, this point is really comes from nitrogen and other things. So if we limit nitrogen, this is basically when carbon is not limiting how fast it can go. When you limit nitrogen, this line gets shifted here. You still have this line, right? So the quantitative prediction, basically combinatorial carbon-nitrogen limitation. About energy, so we did a specific study, never mind about everything else, okay? It was considered two pathways of making energy through mitochondria-like things and just for glycolysis. Okay, and so you have this phenomenon that's known for a long time, that there's acetate excretion if the cell grows at a fast rate. Okay, so this is true for bacteria, to cancer, to everything, that if you force a cell to grow fast, it uses inefficient metabolism. Okay, it burns, but this is acetate. So for E. coli, it secretes acetate. For yeast, it secretes ethanol, that's what we drink, right? And so aerobic, normally if you can burn this into CO2, that's sort of the most efficient process. The cell doesn't do that, okay? And this comes out as another natural, so I need to include the energy sector and do this natural prediction. This come out of the theory, all right? And moreover, the theory can tell you basically how to move this point, right? So when you have a line, it's easy to make predictions, okay? So how does the offset of the slope change? Okay, and in particular, so we understand this as a balance between sort of a, so you need, so the whole thing is this constriction of proteins, right? So when cells are growing fast, cell would like to make ribosomes to grow faster. So to grow fast, you have to have more ribosomes, okay? And so when carbon source is good, okay, then the theory would say that you don't care about minimizing, making energy most efficient. You use the most sort of the leanest proteins that can give you some energy, right? So they can direct ribosome to make more ribosome. And that's how this thing appears. And using this, then we can do this sort of a test, okay? And one last thing is the same thing for stress response. Like, so if you plot growth rate, we throw it at, say, osmotic stress. You ask biologists, we dump cells in salt, all kinds of things happen in the cell. Potassium level change, lots of things change. Okay, but if you look at the phenomena, if this is normal growth rate at different at the normal salt concentration, when you increase salt, these another set of straight lines. Okay, and you can understand this from basically again proteomic and the sort of carbon concentration.
Okay, they're all parallel.
Almost parallel. Yes. Okay, so that's the program. Sort of we've been pursuing the last 5-10 years, and we are now pushing this forward to, so I think this picture explains fast-growing cells rather well, and we are like expanding to maybe interaction with other cells in the slow growth situation, stationary phase, maybe even to other type of cells, organisms, eukaryotes. Okay, so I just want to close. Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. Well, very, yeah.
So, I mean, for the chemistry, I mean, it seems like a very complicated chemistry problem.
Right.
And of course, experiments and so on. So, is there a H bar or a K Boltzmann, or what is there a hint at a structure that?
Right. So, the title of this talk is a phenomenology, right? I did not mention the word phenomenology, but you know, you decide where is, you know, is the phenomenology, right? And yes, so in principle, I mean, they're really true to phenomenology. I mean, I'm already giving more by making molecular interpretations, okay? But that's a suggestive way to think about it. But I think what we have, at least for fast-growing cells, reasonably growing cells, is we have a kind of a phenomenological framework, right? What is clearly missing is whether there is a statistical mechanics type of thing that provides a shortcut from all of this stuff, you know, the complexity, to such a picture for another organism we know nothing about.
This is like PV equals NKT.
Probably more trivial version than that, right? They're basically, you're talking about various, in the Le Chatelier principle, Henle's law, whatever, you're varying two things, you have a slope, and you realize slope is also a variable, right? And then you try to put it together. But then what is really underlying this? I mean, that's, of course, for everybody, right, to contribute. What?
You had a very simple assumption.
Yes.
Your first guess?
So my first response, right? I mean, this was known for 50 years, okay? So this was actually not new. Data were there. Nobody made a plot. Okay, but we, the students, measured it and plotted it, right? And it came out like this. I just didn't believe it, okay? So for a long time, I thought ribosome, you know, the ribosome is so critical. Regulation, obviously a lot of things regulating it. Okay, I'm not surprised if nature spent a lot of effort to make it simple. This thing, so we particularly look at one particular importer, this sort of so-called best characterizing molecular biology, right, so it's lac transporter. And I knew how complicated it was. I just couldn't believe for a minute, right, it has this simple behavior. And we keep on making more and more measurements, it just gets simpler and simpler and simpler. But finally, but once you accept it, then of course you just come together. So a lot of it is this mantle of how much faith you have to go on. We haven't, no, the E. coli is all we have touched so far.
Yes.
In fact, so you're referring to this regulation scheme, right? So in fact, the publications out there from theorists are saying what the optimal sort of regulation strategy is, and that's a very simple one, intuitive one. You go until you meet the bottleneck, and you just upregulate the bottleneck protein, and then you go to the next bottleneck and the next bottleneck. Okay, so in principle, that, you know, theoretically, that is the best strategy. E. coli uses it's the dumbest kind of a control. Okay, and as to why, I think, so first of all, it will take quite a bit of investment to have a sort of a sensing point, right, to see where things get stuck. Okay, but then, you know, with this particular scheme, you know, the central control is here, that's the central node, right, and it can regulate upstream and downstream. So you never get unstuck. I mean, you never get stuck. There's always a way to help. Now, using unnatural kind of perturbations, we can trick the cell into a trap and get into a bottleneck somewhere else. Then it just stuck for 10 hours, right? Because it cannot get out of it, right? Here you can always get out of it. So maybe it's, you can say robustness, that is, with this simple strategy, it tried to make the control point somewhere it knows how to manage. Oh, and then another point is, so with this theory, the main mystery is why so much of the resource is not used in the growth sector, right? And that's also, so that's kind of the also area we're working on. I think we just came up with a constraint thing. We can even explain that part as well. So then there'll be no parameters, right? For the simple thing. Yeah. Ah, okay, very interesting. So you can do this in different temperature. So we run everything at 37 degrees. So if you say go to 25 degrees, cells slow down by 3 times. You measure the elongation rate, it slows down 3 times. Okay? And if you look at this line, it goes like that, 3 times. Okay? But what's interesting is whatever your medium you have here, it just goes parallel. Okay, so in fact, if you actually look at the breakup of the cell and look at the composition, nothing changes. Almost, maybe a few proteins change. Everything's exactly the same. You cannot see a signature of it. It's so weird, right? So weird. Huh? Yes. 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 it's amazing. When you look at a proteome, it's like a replica of what's at 37 degrees. So basically, anytime you look at time-dependent quantity, you see that change, right? You look at static quantity, you see no change.
What about the relationship between elongation rate and cell division time?
Yeah. So that's this relation here. Oh, no, you mean the cell elongation rate?
Yes.
Oh, the cell elongation rate is basically E. coli, the width doesn't change much. It's, the growth rate is just the cell elongation rate, yes.
There is a division
yes.
that is necessary for
yeah.
Separation
yes.
of cells, and that could occur at different stages
yes.
in the growth
yes.
phase.
Yes.
Is that
this division is not included in this theory, yeah.
Yeah. Outline
yeah.
What do you think would change if you go to the eukaryotic
cell? So we sort of thought through that. Okay, so when you go into eukaryotic cells, some of these numbers change, right? But then the number change in a way that really brought degradation into play. So protein degradation that we were able to throw away. And that brings up some interesting new scenario.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.